Hart understood that, like most Americans who'd discovered the Afghan War, Wilson was in the initial stages of unconditional adulation. Typically, that meant seeing the Mujahideen as pure of heart, brave, intensely religious, and worthy of total support. Like all newcomers, Wilson appeared even to have embraced the fantasy that these tribesmen could weld themselves into a single unified resistance. Hart had gone down this path himself, but that had been long ago. Akhtar and I used to sit around talking about how nice it would be if they could create the equivalent of the Free French and find themselves an Akbar de Gaulle, remembers Hart. But the Afghans are hardly a people, much less a nation. They are a nation of tribes constantly at war with each other. They are very heterogeneous with an extreme ethnocentricity which makes them not only hate or suspect foreigners, but Afghans living two valleys away. Hart had made his peace with this profound flaw in the Afghans, and had even come to believe that a large part of their potency as a guerrilla force came from the fact that they were disunited. It made it hard for them to coordinate their military activities, but it also meant that there was no single leader whose head could be cut off to destroy the insurgency. In fact, there was no centralized anything, except a distribution system for weapons and support that, in utter frustration, the Pakistanis had finally created to impart some measure of organization and control. The ISI, with the consent of the CIA, had chosen seven leaders from a mob of heroic chieftains. To a certain extent, the power of the seven and their respective political parties was a creation of Pakistan intelligence. The desperate Mujahideen were told that in order to get weapons, food, medical supplies, training, or assistance for their families, they had to join one of these authorized groups. So began the only form of unity that would exist in this war. It was just an illusion, however, and the only thing that kept the Afghans from one another's throats was their common hatred of the Soviet infidel, and hence the need to restrain their tribal fighting in order to retain access to the weapons and money that the CIA was making available to them. This would become frighteningly clear in 1989, just weeks after the Red Army's withdrawal, when Gulbuddin's commanders in the Helmand Valley would trick a delegation of Massoud's warriors into negotiating. They guaranteed them safe passage, even swearing on a Quran that they would honor this commitment. But once the trusting Tajiks came into the Pashtuns' territory, they were set upon, tortured, and killed. What Hart knew well, even back in 1984, was that there was a cruel and disturbing side to the Afghans. Which is not to say that Howard Hart did not feel deeply about his clients and their cause. Like everyone else, he had been swept up by it. But he put limits on his emotional attachments. Professional detachment was necessary to play the great game effectively. All seasoned commanders are faced with the need in war to sacrifice one flank in a feint, or to lose an entire unit if necessary for the good of the whole. To Hart and the CIA, the Mujahideen had become a division, albeit a strange and unpredictable division, in a much larger struggle against the advancing Soviet Empire. The station chief's task in Afghanistan was to keep the Mujahideen in the field, to give them enough so that they could hope for victory, but not enough to endanger the larger goals of the United States. Above all else, the head of the Islamabad station prided himself on being a realist, and there were profound limits to what was possible in Afghanistan. For him and his agency, the central reality was that the Red Army did not lose wars. Not since 1921, when the Treaty of Riga had ended the Russo-Polish War and ceded Russian land to Poland, had the Soviets been forced from territory they had paid for in blood. Afghanistan would not be another Vietnam. The Soviets didn't operate with the same restraints as the Americans. There was no horde of journalists and politicians questioning every military action. Just across the border from the Mujahideen camps and the great refugee centers in Pakistan, the Soviets were busy carpet-bombing villages, poisoning wells, killing livestock, causing over half the Afghan population to flee their homes. Perhaps it wasn't yet genocide, but the Red Army was capable of almost anything. What was so grating about having to deal with Wilson was that he just didn't understand the game. He seemed to think that the interests of the Afghans and the CIA should be identical. Hart, however, underestimated the twists and turns of Wilson's thinking, both about the Mujahideen and about what he was hoping to accomplish in Afghanistan. On one level, the station chief was right. Wilson did romanticize these mountain warriors. It was the old business of his dying dog, Teddy. Only a Dr. Freud could have fully explained what compelled Wilson throughout his adult life to champion the cause of underdogs. But there was never any question that his mind always raced back to that moment with his mutt writhing on the drugstore floor, dying from the ground glass that the selectman had poisoned him with. 40 years later, Wilson didn't just want to help the Afghans, he needed to help them. They too had been poisoned, their children maimed with toy bombs. Old men were being thrown down wells by the communist thugs. Gunships were swaggering through the skies looking for caravans of mules or camels to mow down. They were wiping out villages friendly to the rebels. They were even murdering columns of refugees just for sport as the women and children tried to walk out of the country. In the landscape of Wilson's mind, the hind had become the murderous selectman, but the Mujahideen weren't giving up, and Wilson wanted revenge for them. As a boy, he had been inspired by the struggle of World War II, where the United States had demonstrated that it had the power to work its will when it had the courage to fight. The lines he had read on the marble walls of the Lincoln Memorial the day he had arrived in Washington to take office had never left him, the lines about the soldiers who had died at Gettysburg. "We here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom." To Wilson, Afghanistan was every bit as important a battlefield for democracy as Gettysburg, but the United States was asking the Mujahideen to give their lives too cheaply. Charlie Wilson wanted to make the Red Army suffer. He was after revenge, and he would prove tireless and maniacal in his drive to arm the Mujahideen. But he was also in ways an unlikely champion of these stoic, bloodthirsty warriors. On a personal level, Charlie was a near pacifist. He had hunted only once in his life as a 12-year-old. He had shot a squirrel in a tree, and when the furry creature had fallen to the ground yelping, Wilson had been horrified at the agony he had caused. The shaken boy had been horrified to have to put the animal out of its misery. Never again would Charlie Wilson raise a gun against a living creature. You would never know this, looking at the gun case in his house on Crooked Creek in Lufkin. It is filled with weapons from around the world. Uzis from Israel, M-16s, Russian assault rifles, Enfields, shooting canes, shotguns, 30-06s, and pistols large and small. But never would this congressman fire one to take a life. Outside his home along the creek, he's installed 40 bird feeders and countless varieties flock to take advantage of the New Deal breakfast he provides year-round for the cardinals and sparrows and blue jays. There are also specially designed feeders with corn cobs and a sitting perch, where the squirrels can eat with the knowledge that no one will be coming after them in this game preserve. But when it came to the Afghan War, this soft-hearted bird lover was out for blood. What Howard Hart did not understand was that Wilson was not just swept away by the romance of the freedom fighters. There was a more pragmatic side to his embrace of them, something akin to the friendship that Winston Churchill developed for Joseph Stalin during World War II. "I like that man," Churchill had told Anthony Eden in an impulsive moment. Churchill, however, had not been naive about Stalin. More than anyone in the West, he knew that the Soviet leader was responsible for the murder of millions. But context is everything, and in the 1940s, during the struggle for the world, the Prime Minister found it nothing short of exhilarating to have the guns of this thug and his Red Army targeted on Hitler. Before the war was over, the Soviets would pay the price of 20 million lives to put down the Nazis. Having an ally like that was no small thing. What Hart could not quite comprehend was that, in the end, what the congressman liked most about the Afghans was their terrifying passion to kill the common enemy, their refusal to bow under in spite of the odds. He even admired their revenge-taking when they would put their prisoners to gruesome deaths. Although Hart didn't yet know it, any ability that he might have had to modify Wilson's designs was all but lost late that night in Peshawar at the Pearl Intercontinental. Well after the last Afghan leader had left and Charlie and Snowflake went to bed, there was a knock on the congressman's door. Snowflake was frightened at first to hear the whispering voices of the Mujahideen. Professor Mojadedi, accompanied by his bodyguards, entered the room carrying something in a pillowcase. Snowflake said she backed off as Mojadedi pulled a captured Russian AK-47 out of the pillowcase. It was very hushed, and this private, quiet ceremony unfolded, she remembers from her cramped quarters in Beverly Hills, where she is still trying to get established. The professor presented the AK with great solemnity. It was the sincerest thanks he could offer for the Erlikons. This was the kind of gesture that moved a Texan like Charlie Wilson. He'd be with them now to the end, and the only end was victory.